This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, deadly rioting broke out across Haiti and Egypt, where rampaging inflation has driven up the price of food. The United Nations estimates that the cost of food in those countries has nearly doubled in the last 2 years. In Egypt, bread is said to be so scarce that in some places it is sold behind a barricaded wall. The 9,000 UN peacekeeping troops in Haiti have been ordered not to fire on civilians, while widespread looting and violence continues. The G7 met in Washington, D.C. on Friday to address instability in the global economy, but many analysts seem skeptical about how effective that group will be at steadying inflation. Bettina Luger is the chief North American spokesperson for the United Nations World Food Program, and she joins us from our studios in New York. Bettina, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
And what are some of the causes that you can list that seems to be driving up the price of food around the world?
Well, we are seeing a perfect storm. Several factors are coming together. One is the rise in oil and energy prices. And, of course, energy is and fuel is very important to transport food. Then we've got an economic boom in some of the developing countries like India and China, and they are exporting much more food, cereals, for example, than in the past. And we have climate change, and we see the effects of that, more droughts, more floods, and that means much worse harvests. Australia, for example, has lost several harvests. And we have the competition between food and fuel. Many farmers have shifted from wheat to corn. So we see the lowest food reserves in some 30 years on the world.
Let me follow up a bit on the biofuels question, because you saw what I think they would count as an unexpected agreement maybe between Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank, and for example, Paul Krugman, the columnist, who each seem to think that biofuels, or the success of biofuels in the past few years, is in fact contributing as a major cause of the price of food increasing.
Yes, I mean, we don't want to, you know, categorize the biofuels as either good or bad. But what we're really seeing, it's part of the market speculation that is going on. Sometimes farmers are betting that would be a much better investment. And some of the foods could have been used for food and are now being used for fuel.
Mr. Zoellick also said that globalization is changing what people eat. And that's changing sort of the task of the world food supply.
Yeah, what we're seeing, for example, in China is that since that country has grown and developed so much and has seen such an economic boom, that people are demanding much higher quality foods. They're moving from rice much more, for example, and now also want to have meats. So that's another effect that you are seeing.
What do you see as the options for the World Food Program and let's say, the industrialized states in the world?
The most important thing is now to get money so we can do the aid operations on the ground. In the long run, we're looking also at safety nets. And one thing that we as the World Food Program are doing, which is a very, very successful program, is our school feeding. It costs 25 cents a day to feed a child in school, $50 a year. And that is one of the long-term things where we think that from the richer countries, much more money should be spent on programs like that so that we can have a long-term impact in the field.
Bettina Luger, Chief North American Spokesperson for the United Nations World Food Program, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
And you can hear reports on the causes and consequences of the world food crisis all next week on Morning Edition and Weekend Edition. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. In a tiny studio in a modest house in East Hampton, New York, artist Ellen Frank is reviving a notion from the Renaissance. It's the atelier, a workshop where apprentices learn from a master by working on his or her original works. What's more, Ellen Frank is working with them to learn another age-old skill, the art of illumination. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
I'm walking through an art exhibition at Concordia College. It's a small college in Bronxville, New York. The show is called Cities of Peace, 9 large canvases, each honoring a city that has experienced trauma. Baghdad, Lhasa, Kabul, Beijing, Monrovia, Jerusalem, Hiroshima, Sarajevo, New York. Each painting uses words and images, forms and texts from the history of that city. And in addition to paint, each includes precious metals, 22-karat gold leaf, silver, moon gold, and crimson leaf. Applying these metals to a painting or manuscript is the ancient art of illumination. The most recent work in the collection is Monrovia. When you look at this painting of the Liberian capital, the first thing you see is a blue and silvery sky. Artist Ellen Frank.
It's the night sky, if you were standing in Monrovia the night that independence was declared for Liberia?
The painting involved months of research and talking to people.
Astronomers who have figured out the night sky on computers, a poet from Monrovia whose mother died in the wars, helping us, all sorts of people stepping forth with each painting.
For Baghdad, there are Islamic texts and complex geometric patterns. New York has words in 40 languages, the outlines of skyscrapers in silver, and in an upper corner, two thin lines of crimson leaf, just the idea of sunset gleaming on the twin towers. Hiroshima is based on the pre-attack map used by the Air Force in the attack, in white gold and moon gold, with winter-blooming plums cascading across the painting's surface. Frank says her approach may not be fashionable in some parts of the art world, but the goal here is to make these paintings unabashedly beautiful.
The cities are, in fact, cities that have suffered horrific trauma and anguish. So the goal of Cities of Peace is the transformation of anguish into beauty.
This project began after Frank made a trip to Jerusalem and felt the tension in that city near the time of the Intifada. Jerusalem, A Painting Toward Peace, became the first city in what has become an ongoing series. Since each painting is a huge effort, she enlisted the help of interns by advertising on Craigslist. Molly Cashwell, an artist and student of art history, saw the notice and came down from Maine.
I had never done a 6-foot by 9-foot painting before. So it was something like that as an artist on your own, as a young artist, to say you're going to do this is completely daunting. But when you have guidance and when you have camaraderie and all of these things, it makes it such an educational experience. It was like being brought into like a very, very large, large network. The world's got a lot bigger.
The apprentices, a few at a time, usually come for several intense months. At this moment, the atelier is occupied by Kat Helmore from England, Sharmila Majumdar, who lives in Detroit, and Juliet McPeak, who lives on Long Island. Right now, they are working on a different project. Frank has been commissioned to create 3 illuminated pages for a book for Passover. She and her apprentices spend much of their time doing very detailed work.
We just don't like this color, and that's why I'm taking it off.
We're taking it off because we don't like it, and we're taking it off because the painting technique was not refined enough.
Okay.
When you scrape the gold leaf off, it scrapes the paint off as well.
Yes, so we retouch. You're going to practice a very light hand.
And while technique is essential, interwoven with the teaching of skills is history and even spirituality. Here Frank is talking about the process of working in gold leaf, building a bed of clay and then putting on binder onto which the gold is pressed.
I'm stirring the clay. It's thought that from the earliest illuminated manuscripts from the 9th century, that clay is humankind. Clay is man. Adam is made of clay, dust to dust, earth to earth. This is the earth. And then put upon it is a glue or a mordant, that which marries the clay to the gold. And the gold then is divinity, or perfection, or ultimate beauty, so that the illuminated manuscript itself is a marriage, not only between word and image, but it's a marriage between the flawed human and the divine perfection. So you see, it should look like heavy cream. That should be the consistency of it.
In the atelier, the senior artist works side by side with the apprentices. Frank lets them work on all aspects of the paintings, the research, the consultation with experts, the design, the execution, even certain business aspects like the administration of her foundation, grant writing, and arranging showings. And while they are working on her paintings, Frank believes that what they learn will transfer to their own artistic efforts.
I think we bring back an intimacy of mentorship and training where the apprentice or the intern learns directly from the experienced artist and learns the artist's style and skill. They also acquire validation. It's not teaching through critique. It's not teaching through judging their own work. It's teaching through saying, yes, and why not try this? And yes, can you push this further?
The apprentices also get credited for their work, and their names always travel with the paintings when they are shown in galleries. Frank even believes that the end of the atelier has meant the decline of technique and craft.
Interns actually become better at technique than I am. They become able to achieve things because they do it and do it and do it. And their learning curve is very steep.
Frank says her dream of an illumination atelier started years ago around her kitchen table and tiny studio. But her real dream for the future is an open atelier where all kinds of people, not only professional artists, can come and learn, even me.
Take the ball of your index finger,
yes,
and you rock it back and forth. And you can press hard, don't be afraid. Now comes the magic moment.
Okay.
You're going to lift it up.
I'm going to lift it up.
Lift the tissue up.
I'm going to lift it up.
And it didn't stick.
It didn't stick.
Oh, well. Ellen Frank says I can come back anytime and try again. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
You can find pictures of Ellen Frank's work and some of her apprentices at our website, npr.org.
In May of 2004, a composer named Nobu Uematsu joined the Los Angeles Philharmonic for a single performance of his most famous work. The show sold out in 3 days. There was almost a riot at the box office when people couldn't get tickets. What was this music? The theme from Final Fantasy, a video game. Now, rewind the story of video game music back to the early 1970s, and you hear this. This is Pong. It was one of the first arcade games. The players hit a ball back and forth across the center line. Its sound is not exactly symphonic.
Playing all those arcade games, I never even paid attention to the music.
This is Jack Wall. He's one of the top composers of video game music today. We're backstage at the Nob Hill Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco. Back in the 1980s, Jack Wall was pumping quarters into a Pac-Man machine, like everyone else his age. But Wall says the music didn't really do much for him.
It just sounded like sounds to me. However, you know all the tunes. It's so funny. The bleeps and the bloops, they kind of like invade your brain.
Like what?
I know, like the Super Mario Brothers theme, you know?
Can you sing it?
Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
It was catchy. It was fun. But it's not exactly serious music. I've caught up with Jack Wall and another famous game composer named Tommy Tallarico. They're in San Francisco on tour with Video Games Live. It's a traveling show of game music, and it's played by top symphony orchestras. These guys are not kids. They're in their 40s, but they're totally hip. Designer t-shirts, jeans, sneakers. Tommy Tallarico wears a black leather motorcycle jacket. He says the music for those early games may sound trivial, but it wasn't. It was there for a reason.
They did a study, actually. And if you remember in Space Invaders, you know, as the ships started to come down, the aliens, dun, 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 dun. And as they got closer and closer, the sound got faster and faster. Now, what the game programmer did was that they took the person's heart rate, and people would start, as they're getting closer and closer, people would start to panic. Now, they do the same studies without the sound, and the people wouldn't panic as much. It goes to show and prove how significant audio and music are. It's not a passive, you know, linear medium, you know, like film or television, but when you're interactive like that, it brings it to such a higher level for the senses.
This is the purpose of all great music, Tallarico says, to change your heart rate, to move you, make you feel. At this point, though, video game music was still very limited by the computers the games were played on. PCs and game systems weren't powerful enough to handle much more than simple electronic melodies. The processing power they did have was dedicated mostly to the game. The music was background. Still, composers started drawing from more serious influences. Take Tetris. This simple puzzle game swept the country in the early 90s. Its music comes from a Russian folk song. Then came a quantum leap in technology, the CD-ROM. Suddenly, games could have detailed video, whole animated scenes, and music, real music. This is Myst. It came out in 1993. Jack Wall says it was the first time he realized the power of music in video games.
It was a funny game because it was the first time you ever played a game and had no idea what you're supposed to do. Remember, I don't know if you remember playing it, but you put the CD-ROM in, you hit start, and you hear the main theme. And it's da 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 da. And you have no idea what to do. And then you'd come up to something new, and suddenly this mysterious piece of music, and it was kind of like a clue. It was like, oh, I need to do something here. So it kind of led you through this world, and the music very much was so important to that.
This music is complex, it's sophisticated, and it's a powerful part of the game's design. From here on, video game music is more and more symphonic. Jack Wall went on to score the third and fourth installments of the Myst series. A major influence? Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. Now this is Wall's theme for Myst 3. Game music had gone from bleeps and bloops to this. Much more like writing a film score, says composer Tommy Tallarico, only better.
In a film, even the great John Williams has to at some point sit down with George Lucas, and George Lucas has to say, okay, John, at 52 seconds, the music has to do this because Darth Vader walked through the door. And then at 2 minutes, it has to do this because the Death Star blows up. Whereas a game designer will come to me and they'll say, you know what, here's the situation. We have 100 guys on horseback with swords all coming to attack you. Write me a 3-minute piece of music. Now my barriers are broken down. Now ideas are in my head and I can start to create. You know, video game music isn't passive. It's not background music. We're foreground music, you know. And it's for this reason why I've always said that if Beethoven were alive today, he'd be a video game composer.
Well, that's quite a statement to say that about Beethoven. I would not go so far.
This is Joshua Bell. He's a concert violinist and self-described video game addict.
Beethoven changed the world as we know it, and I doubt he would have done that through video games. But if it's done well, it can be elevated to something that can have an impact on one's emotions, so I guess you would call that serious music. I would have a hard time putting it on the level of a Beethoven symphony.
Joshua Bell says game music is much more cinematic and interesting today, and he'd like to play on a video game score someday. He may get that chance. Here at the Nob Hill Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco, musicians take the stage. The piccolos pipe through the scales. The harpist practices arpeggios. The violas tune and retune. These are world-class musicians, and they're seated for a dress rehearsal of Video Games Live. Kay Stern is the concertmaster of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. They last played Madame Butterfly. Tonight, she's playing the theme from BioShock.
Okay, so here's a solo I just got like 2 minutes ago. Like that.
So is video game music serious music?
Absolutely. It's creating drama and telling a story and making things more exciting, and it's as much of a picture as you're seeing visually. In fact, many times, even in Wagner operas, the music tells a lot more about what's going on emotionally than the words do.
The cellists are across the podium. I ask their names.
Emil Maland.
Nina Flyer.
Did I hear a little bit of something? Say, Bioshock?
Bioshock! Okay, Nina, right there.
Okay, okay. Here we go. Right there, okay.
Here we go.
Okay.
2, 3, 4.
Tommy Tallarico and Jack Wall say they love this, taking video game music to the world's great orchestras.
People come up to me at the end of the first rehearsal and say, you know what, I really love what you do. Thank you so much for coming here. This is so much fun.
And when are you coming back?
Yeah, when are you coming back?
Yeah, so. We'll get people like, you know, come up to us saying, you know, I've been playing the oboe for 40 years and no one's ever shouted out after my oboe solo, you know, so it's, you know, they don't do that for Stravinsky and Mozart and Beethoven, you know, and they should, but that's the thing is that, you know, people think of symphony performance, shh, everyone be quiet. People in tuxedos are about to come on stage and shh, and then we golf clap afterwards and then, you know, and with our show, we right from the start, we tell the crowd, look, it's okay to shout out, it's okay to scream and clear and jab, it's okay to have fun. And you know what? The musicians, of course, feed off that energy. It's like they're a field day, you know, the one day a year where they can kind of loosen their collars a little bit and have fun, and they're playing to a whole brand new audience, which is great for everyone.
To Tallarico and Wall, it doesn't matter if the purists ever take video game music seriously. The musicians love it. The audiences love it. They're doing more than 50 shows this year. New York City's Beacon Theater, the Royal Concert Hall in Glasgow, Scotland, Taiwan's Panchao Stadium in Taipei. Serious musicians are beginning to catch on. This summer, the Berklee College of Music will run an intensive course in composing music for video games. The Thornton School of Music at the University of Southern California teaches classes in game composition. And who knows, sometime soon, at a symphony near you, you may find on that evening's program Beethoven, Bach, and Bioshock. Our feature was produced by Phil Harrell. You can hear a range of classic video game music, plus new compositions, on our website, npr.org/music.
Knock'em Stiff is tough stuff. To describe the stories in this book as gritty is a bit like calling Antarctica chilly. Knock'em Stiff, by the way, is a real town in southern Ohio where the author, Donald Ray Pollock, grew up. Characters in his stories beat each other out of boredom, drink themselves into stupors, soil themselves, and assault their neighbors. As one character, Big Bernie Givens, puts it, "I'm 56 years old and sloppy fat and stuck in southern Ohio, like the smile on a dead clown's gluteus maximus." And he didn't say gluteus maximus. Knock'em Stiff is the first collection of stories published by Donald Pollock, who worked in a shoe factory, then a paper plant for 32 years, married 3 times, was in rehab 4 times, finally left his job at the mill to become a writer. And now he has. Donald Ray Pollock joins us from the studios of KPLU in Seattle. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Knock'em Stiff is an actual place, but these aren't the people you grew up with. You take some pains to say that.
Most of the people around where I live know where Knock'em Stiff is, so I wanted to make sure that they didn't think that It was a nonfiction memoir or anything like that.
But on the contrary, you say the people you grew up with were very nice.
For the most part, they were, yes.
I want to give people some idea of your prose style, and I wonder if I could get you to read the opening of your story, Hare's Fate.
Sure. When people in town said inbred, what they really meant was lonely. Daniel liked to pretend that anyway. He needed the long hair. Without it, he was nothing but a creepy country stooge from Knockemstiff, Ohio. Old people glasses, and acne sprouts, and a bony chicken chest. You ever try to be someone like that? When you're 14, it's worse than being dead. And so, when the old man sawed off Daniel's hair with a butcher knife, the same one his mom used to slice rings of red bologna and scrape the pig's jowl, he might as well have cut the boy's ugly head off, too.
I'm struck by something you say later in the story about this character, Daniel. You say he never had anything to celebrate, not once in his whole life.
Yes.
That true of a lot of the characters here?
A lot of the characters live pretty trapped lives. You know, they're caught in a place where they don't particularly want to be in. But at the same time, they just find it too hard to escape.
We want to talk about your history. Because let's put it this way, you come to the craft of being a writer with a whole lot more life experience than certainly the 24-year-old graduate students at the Writers' Workshop in Iowa who come out of Princeton and go there.
Yeah.
But when you were 12, 13, 14, 17, or 18, did you think about being a writer?
Sure. I always read a lot. Now, there wasn't a lot of books in the home or anything like that, but probably by the time I was a freshman in high school, I'd pretty much read everything in the small library we had at the school. And I always thought, you know, maybe that would be a nice way to get along in the world, you know, to be a writer, but I never really had the discipline or the wherewithal to try until I was about 45 years old.
What happened?
I just realized that if I ever wanted to do anything else with my life, I was going to have to try now. And so I told my wife that I would give it 5 years and see what happened. And at the end of the 5 years, I had published maybe four stories and been accepted to the MFA program at Ohio State.
You worked 32 years in a paper plant, right?
Yes.
What kind of work?
Well, it was all factory work, of course. I wasn't in management or anything. And the last 18 years that I was there, I worked in the power plant and took care of the ash coal silos. You know, I kept them empty, drove a truck, pretty much just all labor.
Did you let your mind wander? Were you salting away stories?
Well, yes. I mean, after I got used to the job, it was pretty easy to daydream. So I think some of the ideas probably came from while I was driving the truck.
Well, what's the process of writing like for you?
Once I could get the first line of the story and a voice in my head, the writing, I won't say it came easily, but I could always get something. Once I got a voice in my head where, you know, I had this person talking to me, and then a lot of revision.
I want to give people some idea of the quality of the opening line you have in stories. Almost at random, the story Bakhtin begins, "I'd been staying out around Massaville with my crippled uncle because I was broke and unwanted everywhere else, and I spent most of my days changing his slop bucket and sticking fresh cigarettes in his smoke hole." Wow, what a beginning.
Yeah, that was a good one. I think readers are so impatient that if you don't get them with the first sentence or two, you've probably lost them, you know, a lot of times.
We mentioned that you'd been married three times, right?
Yes.
Which is, I'm sorry if this is intrusive, but the wife who agreed that you've got to try it now, sweetheart, 5 years to be a writer, is that the woman to whom you're still married?
Yes, it is. I'm still married to her, and we're doing well.
What were those 5 years like? There must have been some anxiety.
I didn't have a lot of expectations, And so when I started out, I also didn't know too much about how to begin. And so I would type out stories that I liked on a typewriter.
You mean type other stories out?
Yes, type other writers' stories. Right. You know, I'd never been in a writing workshop or anything, and I, you know, it just seemed to be a way to get closer to figuring out how other writers did what they did. So I did that quite a bit.
What stories do you remember?
Several from Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son, quite a few Hemingway stories, some Flannery O'Connor, mm-hmm. Barry Hanna stories, John Cheever, Richard Yates. I tried quite a few different writers.
What would you learn by typing them?
I think one of the principal things I learned from typing the stories out was how dialogue works. Also, just, you know, things about structure. And, you know, I could read a story, but I really wouldn't see how it worked until I got closer to it.
Is there something to be said for waiting until you're pushing 50 to start writing?
Well, I think for me, working all those years in the paper mill and being around all of those blue-collar people, you know, union workers and, you know, even being married a couple times, all that kind of stuff, it helps as far as, you know, having a lot of life experience. You know, I've got a lot of stories that I think I could tell if I can just put them down on paper.
Mr. Pollack, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure talking to you, too.
In Seattle, Donald Ray Pollack, his new book, his first, is Knock 'em Stiff. And you can read an excerpt from Donald Ray Pollack's story, Real Life, on our website, npr.org/books. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Although Syria is beginning to open itself to foreign visitors, it remains a strictly controlled society. There is one exception. Students are flocking to Syria to pursue Arabic language studies, including many from America, despite the tense relations between the two governments. As NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Damascus, many students say they find Syria a different place from what they'd imagined.
Since 9/11, Arabic speakers have been in high demand in the U.S. and elsewhere. For a long time, the primary overseas destination for students of Arabic was Egypt, and that remains true today. But Damascus is seeing a growing influx of students signing up for language studies at both religious and secular schools.
Damascus University is a mix of concrete classrooms and tree-lined green spaces where young men and women gather in small groups or study alone. At the Higher Language Institute, in addition to Arabic, you can hear English, German, Italian, and Japanese being spoken by some of the many foreign students who come here to study both spoken and written Arabic.
For the American and European students here, a couple of key factors drove the decision to come to Syria, a state condemned by Western politicians as a sponsor of terrorism. First, the low tuition and cheap housing available in Damascus offer a much better deal than the American universities in Egypt or Lebanon. In addition, the Syrian dialect is considered by some to be closer to classical Arabic. British student Anise Turner had no problems convincing her parents about the move. In fact, she says it was her father, CBS News cameraman Nick Turner, who encouraged her to consider it. After 7 months here, the city's deep history and friendly inhabitants have won her over.
I love it. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. Some people maybe from the West, when they come here, they think it's a bit chaotic, but Syria, for me, is the safest country I've ever been in. I feel safer in Damascus than I do feel in London.
Sipping tea at one of the venerable old restaurants in Damascus' old city, American students Kara Francis and Ashley Milko share the positive view of Syrian hospitality, beauty, and culture. The 25-year-old Francis was studying Arabic in Washington, D.C., when she realized if she wanted to become fluent, she'd better come to the region and study intensively. She's been pleased to find a complete lack of anti-Americanism so far.
No, to the contrary. Every time I tell a Syrian that I'm American, they just get really excited and happy. And, you know, they say that they don't like Bush. And I tell them I don't either. And then we don't. I mean, Syrians can't really talk about their own politics very much. So the topic of conversation moves away from politics to things like family and schooling.
23-year-old Ashley Milko has also found common ground with young Syrians, but at the same time, she's getting a first-hand view of the problems here, and that's an important part of the experience.
I'm definitely glad I came, not only for my Arabic studies, but for gaining a more realistic, on-the-ground perspective of not only Syria, but its relation to its neighbors and its position in Middle Eastern politics. I've been really happy with how open people are. Not as many girls here wear headscarves as I thought, but at the same time, I think it's a city that's somewhere in the middle of the developing world and the developed.
So if Syria was hoping that these language programs would amount to a charm offensive among impressionable young students, Kara Francis says the reality is quite a bit more complicated, especially for a young Western woman.
I think it's easy to idealize this place before you come, and it's easy to walk around as a tourist especially and think that it's great, it's lovely, the old city is charming, people are so friendly and welcoming. But if you spend a little bit longer here, you see the bad things about this place. You see the poverty, you see how Syrian men treat you as a foreign woman. That's difficult.
All three of these young women said although they've never felt threatened, the aggressive attentions of Syrian men were difficult to adjust to. Even more of a shock was how Syrian women are treated and the lack of opportunities they face. But in the end, these students say that may be the most valuable lesson of all, not to simply be dazzled by the beauty of Damascus, but to come away with a fuller, more nuanced picture of a society that was largely opaque to them before. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Damascus.
This is music from the new film, The Visitor, which opens this weekend. The combination of this spare classical piano and the rhythmic West African drum is like a summary of The Visitor's plot. The main characters are an immigrant from Syria, whose big passion in life is his girlfriend, and drumming, and a straight-laced older white man who learns to let go through music. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, The Visitor shows what can happen when two people from different worlds come together.
Walter Vail is a global economics professor at a college in Connecticut. He's a widower whose late wife was a concert pianist. He's trying to connect with his grief by taking piano lessons himself.
Don't flatten. Make room for the train.
And not getting very far.
Learning an instrument at your age is difficult, especially if you don't possess a natural gift for it.
That doesn't help Walter's already sullen mood. He goes to his old apartment in New York City and finds a young immigrant couple living there through a real estate scam. Eventually, they become friends, especially Walter and the boyfriend, Tarek, a Syrian who plays the West African drum, the djembe. Tarek teaches Walter to play.
Now, Walter, I know you're a very smart man, but with a drum you have to remember not to think. Thinking just screws it up, okay?
Okay.
Now give it a couple of bangs. Not so hard, you're not angry at it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The contrast between the drum and the piano is almost a metaphor for what happens to Walter through the course of The Visitor, says screenwriter Tom McCarthy.
Here's a guy who starts off with an interest in classical piano, and obviously is tied into his wife, who has since passed away. And it's his journey from this sort of, at least at this point, this heady instrument that he can't seem to get the hang of, to this African drum, to the djembe. It's sort of the difference in instruments. I mean, the drum is something you don't even have to be good at it. It can just be a sort of cathartic experience. You can really commit to it.
But first, you have to learn to play it.
I actually never touched the drums in my life, but maybe the singing helped me a little bit with the rhythm and the timing.
Actor Haz Sleiman, who's originally from Lebanon, says it was easy to connect with his character.
Tarek's path, like he moved from Syria to Michigan and then from Michigan to New York to pursue music, and I did exactly the same, only like from Lebanon to Michigan and then to New York to pursue a career as a recording artist. So I thought that was like one of those things where you think like the planets are aligned in some way.
To learn how to play the djembe, Sleiman spent several weeks taking daily lessons from a professional musician from Ghana. What was the first thing you learned on the drum? And I'd love if you could demonstrate.
It's pretty much actually the beat that I teach Richard in that scene.
So that's that would be it. It's a very simple beat, as you can tell.
Some might say deceptively simple. Good drummers make it sound easy. But Richard Jenkins, who plays Walter, the older white guy, says he played drums for about 5 years when he was a teenager and never felt he played well.
I never got out of my head as a drummer. You know, I was still always counting, and I wasn't getting any better, so I stopped.
Richard Jenkins says he, too, has a lot in common with his character. He says he's not very adventurous and needs to be pushed to try new things. In The Visitor, music has a freeing quality for Walter Vail, like when the young Tarek insists that he listen to the Afropop star Fela Kuti.
And when I saw the film, I could almost see me relax when the fella music started.
Throughout The Visitor, Walter Vail often looks like a fish out of water. In one scene, he musters up enough courage to play in a drum circle in New York City's Central Park. With his button-down shirt and tie and a tense look on his face, he sits in a line of musicians, all looking joyful, dressed in African clothes or T-shirts and jeans. But once he starts playing, Walter blends right in. In many ways, The Visitor is a movie about taking a leap of faith, whether it's moving to a new country, befriending someone from a different class or culture, or learning a new instrument. Screenwriter Tom McCarthy says to take that leap, you need to get out of your comfort zone.
I think the key is always, honestly, as Tarek's character says in the film, to get out of your head, don't think. So I think this movie has a little bit about music allowing someone to drop down out of their head and into their body and into their life.
But that doesn't mean things end up well for any of the characters in The Visitor. It's also a story about the precarious existence of immigrants in America. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
And Tom McCarthy talks about researching immigration and the composer whose music he used in The Visitor at npr.org/movies.